thing, and they found that it could turn, you know, they could it could turn a valve handle, a great big valve handle if they needed to do something with the robot for you know, on Earth for rescuing people. They need to send the robot into a dangerous area. It could turn, close the valve. They showed it could operate a drill. They showed the thing operating, drilling through cinder blocks. They also showed it driving a car, and it's got legs and feet and a head. And this is the one that they it was also famous for shooting a gun. They put a gun in its hand and it was able to shoot. So now they decided, let's send this thing up to the International Space Station and see how it does in microgravity. And let's, we'll weighs like 350 pounds, so it's around 5 foot, I think, 5 foot eight. And they put it inside this unmanned spacecraft. They figure might as well send it up anyway. And they want to leave it up there for a week and then bring it back. It's not going to be up there long. You know, they said a week to 2 weeks. When it was going up, they showed pictures of the thing moving its head left and right. But it wasn't programmed to operate any of the buttons or switches. So it was just really going along for the ride. Russians have an automatic docking system. When it gets up near to the International Space Station, it gets very close, and it turns on the KURS radar system. The radar system sends out a little over three gig transmission. I think it's 3.3 gigahertz, and it transmits to the International Space Station. And the docking, wherever it's going to dock, has a receiver and an amplifier to transmit a signal back to the KURS. And what's supposed to happen is the unmanned, in this case the unmanned spacecraft, which would normally be manned, receives the signal. The spacecraft does the math and it figures out how far away it is from the space station. You have to go left, right, up, down, your pitch, whatever it might be, and then it comes in and docks automatically. And this is the normal way they do it with a crew. That's their system. If that system should fail for any reason, the crew would take it over manually and drive it in and dock anyway. What happens is, because this is an unmanned vehicle and it's not a progress mission, that they have a little different system on the progress cargo ships. For instance, progress can come up by itself and it goes into a dock manually or automatically by itself, and if something should fail, the crew on board the International Space Station, the Russians, would operate it from inside the space station. It's called the TORO system, and TORO is an acronym, but it, you know, it's for Russian. It essentially means a teleoperated mode for controlling a spacecraft. Well, the TORO system is not part of this system because it's a manned spacecraft. So here you have this unmanned spacecraft with a robot in it, nobody able to control anything. And sure enough, it was going to dock to the poised docking mode on the International Space Station, which is located on the Zenith, the upper part of the module. You know, so now if this thing gets near with the KURS on, the radar, gets within about 300 feet, it doesn't see a signal coming back, so it stops in space. A little thrust come on, just sits there, and then they showed it wobbling back and forth, searching, looking for the signal, and it wasn't getting anything. So the crew on board has a button that they can push. The Russians push a button to abort the whole thing, so the spacecraft started backing away from the International Space Station, and it's now just floating near the space station. They came up with a new plan. I thought they were going to come up with this too, because what happens is there's many docking ports. The Americans, we have four docking situations, and the Russians now have four docking situations. They could have, let's say, two spacecraft attached, which they do now for people, and then they could have two Progress cargo missions, and they're all interchangeable on their docking ports. So what they did is they said, okay, we know that this other docking port is good, but it happens to have a spacecraft attached to it at this time. Right now there's six people on board the space station, so each one holds three people. So there's two actual spacecraft attached to the space station. So there's one spot, it's called the Zvezda module, the big Russian module at the very end of the International Space Station. We know that Kurs amplifier system is working, so we're going to put a crew in there, and it's 11 o'clock. They started around 11 o'clock. They put all three crew members into the Soyuz spacecraft, and they're going to detach from the Zvezda module and fly around. It's going to take about a half hour. They're going to fly around to the Poiska module. That's the one with the broken Kurs unit. But since you now have a crew in there, like I said before, a live crew, could override the Kurs situation and go in manually and dock. So that's what they're going to do. They're going to put all three people in the spacecraft, back away from the International Space Station, go above it, and then dock it to the Poiska module, and that's the one with the broken radar setup. Once they do that, that will free up the tail end, the Zvezda docking point with the operating Kurs radar. So that means probably tomorrow night, they'll bring the other Soyuz craft, this unmanned craft with the robot in it, and they're going to try again, and this time they might get to succeed, because that's what the problem was. Wasn't part of the spacecraft that was fouled up. It was it was part of the radar system. You know, each docking port has its own radar system. So we'll see what happens. And my guess is next week I'll be able to report that the robot made it there and they're able to bring it on board, and they'll be able to play with it for a week or two before they send it back home. Like I said, this is an actual Soyuz spacecraft. It's just unmanned, so when it goes back home, it's not going to burn up over the Pacific Ocean like a regular Progress spacecraft does. You know, it's going to go back to Kazakhstan. It's going to fly back, parachute, come down just like when they had people in it, and hopefully they'll get their robot back. So that's the story on that. I know you brought that up, Dick, but that's what's going on with this whole setup. I mean, they were trying to test something completely different. They wanted to test the compatibility between the spacecraft and this new booster setup that they're using on the Soyuz, which is also got a different second stage to it. They want to make sure everything's separated fine, everything worked great. But lo and behold, something that they thought was going to be no problem in docking, which they've done, you know, dozens and dozens of times before, turned out to be a problem for the Russians. This is WS2N. So any questions regarding this? Comments, questions? I put a picture in there. I don't know if anybody wants to see it, but you can bring up the Fedor, F-E-D-O-R, on your computer. You can see what this thing looks like, and it's really something else. You know, I mean, we've had a robot up there before. It's called Robonaut 2. Robonaut 2 was sent up in 2011, so we're way ahead in the Russians. They used it for a while. It didn't have any legs, and then when they set legs up, they had some problems. Shorts and bad ground wires that weren't installed, so they sent it back down last year on a on a Dragon being worked on now. And probably by the end of this year, they'll send it up on, on another Dragon spacecraft. And Robidoux 2 will be back in operation on board the space station. But this thing will be sent back home. Any questions or comments? Okay, nobody asked me about the why they're sending three people out at one time. You know, instead of putting one person in the spacecraft and back it out, you know, out of one port and go into another port. But in case anybody's wondering, that's the NASA or International Flight Rules. For every person that's on board the space station, ever since they've been doing this year 2000, the flight rules are you have to have a seat for every person that's on board the space station in case of a fire, a problem, disaster, and they have to use the spacecraft to disembark and come back to Earth. When they take a spacecraft out of one port and put it into another port, that's half hour. It's only a half hour. If there was a problem, the other two people on board the space station would not have a seat to get home. So, to avoid that, they all three get into the Soyuz spacecraft. They back it out, and they redock, and then they come back on board. So that's the reason for that. They've done that before, too. Last time they did it was when Scott Kelly was on the International Space Station. And he's one of the twins that he was up there for a year. And they needed to change locations, you know, with the spacecraft and put it into another docking port. And they did the same thing. All three got in there. Took a ride for a half hour and redocked. So that's the story on that. Any comments or questions? Okay. There was an EVA done last week. Two Americans went outside the space station, did a nice EVA. They needed to connect the ITER up the International Docking Adapter, number 3, to the PMA, Pressure Mating Adapter. They needed to connect that to the Zenith point, port of the Harmony node. The Harmony node is a great big node, and, you know, big module. And it has really 6 different connections. Sticking out of the back of Harmony, it's connected to Destiny, another big module. You know, so all these 6 ports will be eventually connected to something. If you go out to the starboard side of the Harmony, you're connected to the Columbia module. Big, great, big module. That's the one where a lot of ham radio contacts are made from. And then if you go out to the port section, you go out that piece of the module, and you're connected to the Kaibo Japanese module. So then you have essentially 3 left. You have one looking straight down. They leave that for the berthing, not docking, but the berthing of other spacecraft. For instance, Dragon and Cygnus would be connected to those modules as, you know, when they come up to resupply the station. So that one's usually occupied. And then you have the one looking forward. You know, as the International Station essentially is going forward, there's a front and a back to this whole setup. Going forward, you have a pressure mating adapter, and you have an ITER, an international adapter that was attached a couple of years ago by spacewalking astronauts, and they do a good job at that one. That's not only functional, that's been used one time when Dragon went up there, the Dragon crew vehicle, not the cargo vehicle, and they sent it up for a test to see if it was going to be able to dock with the space station and come back and land in the Pacific Ocean as if they had a crew in it, and that worked fine. So they used that international docking adapter, and then Now, of course, they need a second one. So the American side will have two berthing ones for big cargo going in. You have bigger doors on that. And you also have two docking adapters where you could have two crew spacecraft attached at the same time. So, for instance, you'll be able to have a cargo connected to the bottom of Harmony, say a Dragon cargo vehicle. You'll also be able to have a cargo crew vehicle, a Dragon crew vehicle attached to the front of the Harmony node via the ITER that was installed. And then you now have another pressure mating adapter sticking out of the top of this thing, they call it the Zenith port. And that's where another pressure mating adapter is presently located. And on top of that, they wanted to put the new ITER in. So ITER was sent up a couple of weeks ago on the cargo vehicle, they call it the trunk of the Dragon cargo. And it was attached to one of the ports. Now they have a robotic arm permanently attached to the space station that grab hold of IDA, they call it IDA 3, and they pull that out and they attached it on during the spacewalk. They brought it very close to the connection of the pressure mating adapter with the robotic arm, and then the crew, Morgan and Hank, went over to do all the hookups. They hooked up wires and cables and power cables and heater cables. And when some of these were actually done, the crew inside the space station was able to activate these tongs that forcefully pull the ITER automatically to the pressure mating adapter for a final fit, and that's where it's going to stay forever. And that was successfully done. They finished up hooking up all their other connectors, and then they put out cameras, which will eventually look to see the approaching vehicles showing up. They put out indicators that the approaching vehicle will be able to look at when it docks at the space station. All that was accomplished. They did this in around, I think, 6.5-7 hours on their spacewalk. And it all went well. Morgan had some communications problems with the, but nothing too serious. So all went well. They were able to accomplish that. And now the space station is completely set up for visiting spacecraft. You could have two cargo vehicles attached from the United States or from another entity such as Japan. Or you could have, and you could also have two visiting spacecraft with people, the spacecraft Dragon crew, or even the Skyliner by Boeing, which should be making its debut flight in a couple of months without a crew, similar to what SpaceX did recently, back in March. So they'll send the unmanned Skyliner up. It'll dock, it'll come back, and it'll land in Utah. That's the one that's got these big airbags. It's actually going to land on land, come back with a heat shield, or it's going to come back with parachutes and these great big airbags that land on land. So, plenty of things coming up for the space station in the near future. And all these projects are designed to set everything up to do just that. So, and that's the story on the spacewalk. The HTV will be coming up and docking to one of those cargo ports in September. Actually, a few days from now, I think 6 days from now, you have the HTV that's going to be launched from Japan. And I believe they call it HTV-8, so it'll be their eighth cargo mission. Japan sends up these vehicles to the space station just like we do, and they supply the space station with cargo. And that HTV right now is presently the heaviest payload that they can bring up. They bring up like 12 or 13,000 pounds of stuff, which is like twice the amount that Cygnus brings up, for around 7,700 pounds. Progress brings up the least now, around 6,000 pounds. They plan on using one of those cargo berthing ports. So we'll follow that in a couple of days. Like I said, around 6 days from now, usually 2 or 3 days before they connect to the space station. They usually grab it with a robotic arm and attach it that way. That's another thing. With the crew vehicles that come up, they don't use the robotic arm. They just, you know, come in autonomously, similar to what the Russians do with both their Progress ships and with Soyuz manned spacecraft. So, let me drop it for any comments or questions. Not hearing any. There's another rocket that's being built. I've mentioned it before in the past, but I don't really give it that much attention because it's probably another year away before they do their first launch. It's called the Omega A, or the Omega. Actually, it's called the Omega, O-M-E-G with a capital A at the end. And it's built by Northrop Grumman. It's all the first couple of stages are going to be solid booster rockets. It also has additional boosters, smaller boosters, also built by Northrop Grumman. It's going to be attached to the side of these things. And essentially, it's a solid booster rocket. You know, pretty much all the way up until the top, the third stage, which will probably be a Centaur liquid oxygen rocket. But it's big. You know, it's probably 290 feet tall, and big enough where they're going to be using the mobile launch platform number 3, you know, with the crawler and everything, just like what they did with Saturn V rockets. They used to come out with that big crawler and bring the whole launch complex and everything from the vehicle assembly building. Well, that's what they're going to do. And this will roll all the way out to Launch Complex 39B, not 39A. 39A presently is being used by SpaceX, which will be launching crew vehicles to the International Space Station, and they also use it for their big Falcon 9 heavy launches. But then there's Launch Complex 39B, which is not too far away. See, 39A and 39B were both used by the space shuttle system. You know, roughly half of the launches went off on one, and the other launches went off on the other. You know, all the space shuttles. They use both A and B. Right now, A is going to be 39A. Is going to be used for crew and for the Falcon 9 Heavy, and 39B is going to be used by two different rockets as well. It's going to be used for this one, the Omega rocket, which is being built by Northrop Grumman. And by the way, it's going to be human rated. You know, somewhere down the line, they're going to be able to say, we'll be able to launch people on this thing as well. But for now, it's going to be, you know, just to put satellites in space. And then the other rocket that's using 39B is the SLS system by NASA. SLS, you know, they're gonna have a crew arm that's gonna connect. You're gonna be able to have what they call a white room, kind of, you know, where astronauts will be able to go up on this thing and get onto the SLS and eventually go to the moon and to Mars. It's a space launch system which is presently under construction, and my guess is the first launch is gonna be sometime in 2021. But they're working toward that. A few years behind that, but they're still at it, and they plan on eventually launching the Orion spacecraft on top of this space launch system. So you'll have the point I wanted to make is now the Omega rocket being built by Northrop Grumman has now found a home to be built, and it's going to be built in the vehicle assembly building. They've turned over, NASA has turned over one of the bays to Northrop Grumman for that purpose. That was the main story. And they're going to reconfigure this whole thing to accommodate the Omega and the launch complex, the launch tower system, launch tower number 3 there, reconfiguring for their rocket. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. China is still out with their launches, but they have private companies now. I believe they're probably subsidized by China, but there's this private company. There's been, I think, 3 or 4 of them, and they haven't really successfully got anything to orbit. They're roughly small rockets, you know, maybe 80, 100 feet tall. No bigger than that. And this company, they call it J-Long 1, or the Smart Dragon 1 rocket, was launched to orbit on their first try. So there's been a couple of companies, and this one has succeeded in doing that. Probably put a couple hundred pounds satellite into space. So, you know, you never know. We have companies, plenty of companies right now trying to do the same thing. They want to be able to cover the small spacecraft that have to be put up into space. You know, you need these satellites for a lot of them are taking pictures of the Earth, and a lot of them are going to be used for internet connections. And when I say a lot of them, they plan on putting thousands of these things, if not 10,000 satellites that are shot, different companies, SpaceX, Amazon, OneWeb, they all have plans of putting thousands of satellites, and they're going to need multiple launch capabilities from many, many companies if they plan on really doing that. And another spacecraft I've been following is Chandrayaan 2. It was launched from India a month or two ago, and it's been in elliptical orbit around Earth. Each time it goes around, it fires its rockets, and each time it gets further and further away from the Earth. It comes back, and then eventually goes a little further. And now this thing apparently has gotten far enough where it fired its retro rockets for 29 minutes, roughly a half hour, to slow itself down to get into orbit around the moon. Apparently that was successful. So Chandrayaan 2 by India, launched on India's rocket, geosynchronous launch vehicle, they call it, was successfully put into lunar orbit. On board is a lunar orbiter, which will stay in orbit. And I believe the beginning of September 8th, I think, or so, they plan on landing on the moon. So it's got this, attached to the front of it is this lander. You can see the four legs sticking out of it. And it's going to slowly, eventually get down to the lunar surface, hopefully. And if it lands, it's got this big door that's going to open up, and this rover is going to come out and start riding around on the moon for a couple of weeks. They made it solar panels, and I don't think there's any RTGs involved, so they don't think it's going to survive the lunar night, but it will survive the lunar day if they can get this lander called Vikram, and that's the lander down to the surface. They have the rover called Pragon, which means wisdom in Sanskrit, but hopefully Pragon is successful, and you'll have a fourth country that will have successfully landed a craft on the moon. And of course, that's the U.S., Russia, China, and now India. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Another mission scheduled to go up in 2021 is the Peregrine. Peregrine is another vehicle that's going to be launched to the moon by a company called Astrobiotica. And it's Peregrine Lander. It's a spacecraft that's very similar to what I was just talking about with India. Same type of thing. It's going to go to orbit and go down and land on the moon. It doesn't have a rover or anything. And it doesn't plan on surviving a lunar night. But it will be a first for a private company to be able to do that from the United States. They plan on now launching on a Vulcan rocket, Vulcan Centaur rocket in 2021. Vulcan is being built right now by Boeing and Lockheed Martin. They collaborate on these rockets. They built the Delta IV, the Delta IV Heavy, and they built a very successful Atlas V rocket. The Atlas V rocket has been going up for years and very successful, 100% success rate. But they do use the Russian engines. They bought a whole bunch of Russian RD-180 engines, and they've been using them successfully for years. They put two of these things in there. Actually one big engine, and off they go. But the new Vulcan rocket that they're building that to replace the Atlas V, and they're also building to replace the Delta IV, which is they just flew their last flight. There's a couple of Delta IV heavies left, but single stick Delta IV they've retired. Nevertheless, the Vulcan rocket is being constructed for a couple of years now. And that's going to have the capability of human rays, and it's also going to have the capability of having solid booster rockets attached to it, similar to what they do with the Atlas V. In Atlas V, you can put up to five solid booster rockets. I think this one could take six. But nevertheless, the Vulcan will have two missions. This is the first mission ever. When they go up, it's going to carry this Peregrine lander all the way to the moon. It's also going to have another satellite that they're going to release. It'll be a dual launch. I haven't figured out what the other satellite's going to be yet, but this one will be heading to the moon. And their next launch after that, the second Vulcan launch, will be carrying Dream Chaser for its first flight up to the International Space Station. Dream Chaser is being built by Sierra Nevada Corporation out of Colorado, and that's the one that looks like they call it a mini shuttle. You know, it has landing capabilities. It'll land on a runway. It's going to be able to bring a large amount of cargo up to the space station, and eventually they have plans on designing it to carry people. Actually, that was the original plan, to have people on board the Dream Chaser. But NASA changed that. They said, we just want cargo for now and people later. Mm-hmm. So they already have a contract with NASA for six missions up to the space station. You know, billions of dollars being transferred for that purpose. And then, of course, after that, they'll try to get more contracts for cargo. The Sierra Nevada Corporation has been around for 40 years or more, and they've been at it for years. And one of the things that they came up with recently is a new habitat system for NASA to think about, and this is one of these inflatable things. They plan on having an inflatable thing with about three different floors in it. It's a massive thing. I think they said the volume of it is equal to around one third of what the International Space Station is right now. And it looks like they're taking a lot of the ideas from Bigelow. Bigelow has this inflatable system. So I'm not sure what the deal is with this. You know, the picture I see that they brought this thing to NASA and NASA's looking at it. In fact, they had astronauts go inside and spend 2-3 days inside to see how it was, how the living quarters are. They've got this big airlock set up connected to it. So they feel they could put this inside of a, you know, 5.5 meter diameter fairing on top of a rocket, and, you know, which is roughly around 18 feet in diameter. And they could grow this thing to about, you know, 30 feet in diameter. And inside it'll have the equivalent of 3 different levels for, you know, up to 4 to 6 astronauts to live on a regular basis. You could either leave this in space around the moon for, you know, part of the gateway system. That's what they were really developing it for. Or you could actually bring it down to the moon's surface and let people live in there. It would be a good place for astronauts to live until they eventually come up with a system, you know, a better system where you could maybe put people on the ground, live in lava tubes or something. But, you know, you're going to need something in the beginning if they really plan on occupying the moon on a permanent basis. Anyway, they gave it a name. They call it LIFE, you know. So this is Sierra Nevada Corporation. They built this thing called LIFE, and it's a large, inflatable fabric environment. Everybody loves these acronyms. And I looked it up. It's about the same living space as Bigelow's 330. Bigelow has the 330, which stands for 330 cubic meters. And what it works out to is around a little over 10,000 cubic feet of space, which is really quite large, considering the Bigelow excursion module, that activity module that's attached to the space station right now, is only 500 square feet. It's 10,600, so. An idea of what they really got planned. So we'll see how that works out. They have to get their contracts together. They're able to get enough money. Right now, it doesn't look good because it doesn't look like Congress is really going to add all the billions of dollars that they're going to need to land their people on the moon by 2024. I think they're going to stick to their original goal in reality. I think I'll be lucky to see somebody land on the moon by 2028. Any comments or questions for that? This is WS2M. Well, I think I covered about enough for now. We'll come back next week and see if they successfully got this robot on board the space station. And we'll try it again. But for now, I'll turn it back to Dick. And see if he wants to ask any questions. Anybody else wants to add to the net, we'll do that. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WS2N for the base portion of the TechNet. By the way, before I do, Roy, if anybody wants to send questions with the SpaceNet report, I think it would be good if we went to the mailbag as well. You know, you have a very easy... easy one to remember. Back to you, Dick.
WS2N, KD2FIU.
Go ahead, George.
Cool. Thank you. Great report. Thanks. All the input.
Very good. Thanks, George, for listening. I know it's a lot, but I try to condense everything you would see in the news, if you see it in the news, and we try to do it... I don't know, like a soap opera, like, we'll see see how they work, how they do next week, and see if the launches that we talk about over the months ever get off the ground. So it's kind of fun to try to follow it. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, is the James Webb Space Telescope still on its reschedule, and I think the latest launch is, roughly in the middle of 2021? Is that back to you, Paul?
Yeah, that's the time frame, I think. Summertime of 2021. From Kourou, French Guiana, down in South America. They'll be launching that. And last I heard, about a month ago, all their workers, there's no more snags anyway. They've been testing this thing. Until the cows come home, they put it into these sub-freezing things. They put it into these areas where they blast the music, not music, blast the sound, the decibels, duplicate launch capabilities. And, you know, they had some problems, and that's why a lot, you know, it's been delayed. It should have been up there 2017. But yeah, you're right, 2021, and Northrop Grumman has got the contract, so they're really involved with everything here. Like I said, they were involved with this rocket that's being built now in Florida, the Omega. They're involved with a lot of they've taken over orbital science, which eventually became Orbital ATK in Virginia, you know, the launch complex down there in Wallops Island. They're involved with the Antares launches, which on top of that they have the Cygnus launches. So it's being run by Northrop Grumman. You know, we all know who Grumman is, but they were gobbled up years ago by Northrop Grumman. But they're still the name is still there, and they're really heavily involved with all these projects, and including James Webb. Back to you, Dick.
I seem to remember that last time I asked this question about James Webb, it was going to be launched from Kourou, South America, using a European Space Agency vehicle that had a lot of track record. Are they still going to use that launch vehicle, or is it a newer launch vehicle that doesn't have as much track record? Over to you, Paul.
Well, they're still going to use the Ariane 5 rocket. There's a couple of launches on that manifest, so I think it's, you know, probably 2022 or something, 2023. I think that will be the end of the Ariane 5 rocket, and that's being taken over by the Ariane 6 rocket, you know, and you know, that hasn't come online yet. I think their first launch is probably going to be 2021, 2022. So this thing was designed for Ariane 5. You know, as long as there's no major delays, yeah, that would be still the rocket that they're going to use. It's very reliable. Some over 80 launches, and all of them were 100%. I did look one up because you asked about it, and there was one failure back in 2000. And, so when they were changing from one iteration of one rocket to another. But make a long story short, they're a very reliable vehicle, and that's why NASA's trusting them. And also because European Space Agency is paying for that launch. It costs, you know, $200 million just to launch this thing. And this way European Space Agency gets some science back from it. Everybody contributes on these international projects. Although it's mostly being built by the United States, of course.
What is the maximum thrust capability, Paul, of an Ariane 5? And approximately, what's the maximum thrust capability on takeoff of an Ariane 6? Over to you, Paul.
I think they're going to be roughly the same, very close to it. Ariane 6 will have the capability of launching without solid booster rockets attached to it. But, you know, they will have it. So once you have that, it's roughly the same. I think it's roughly almost 4 million pounds of thrust with their two solid booster rockets and the their engine, because with a V, I've got their last name. No, that was a Vulcan engine, too, but it was spelled differently. That's what it was. They call it a Vulcan engine. And that's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. And the new one, I don't know if this, I forget about the fuel. I don't know, I don't think they're switching the fuel. They might be. I'll have to check on the Ariane 6, what they got planned. But the thrust should be about the same, probably the almost 4 million pounds of thrust.
The launch of, gee, my voice is low. Gee, my voice has come back a lot stronger. I think there's more than one remote. There it is, more than one remote port that can pick up my voice. I don't know why the volume changes like that, which I think it's on the repeater, not on me, but I'm not positive. There's no flyby capability on the way of James Webb getting out to its Lagrange point behind the moon, roughly a million miles behind the moon. It's not going to fly by any other planet, I think. So therefore, it goes straight there, as I understand it. Is that true, Paul? KJIW?
Yeah, it's just that they know how much it weighs. What is it, 8,000 pounds? They know how much thrust to put into it. The upper stage, you know, is throttled to the proper number, because, you know, they wanted to go out and they just wanted to stop. You know, they push it, you know, it's like throwing a ball up in the air. You want it to just, you know, if you want to get the ball to go to 30 feet, you just throw it enough where it's going to hit 30 feet. And that's what they're doing there, you know. And then once it hits that one location at L1, you know, the gravitational, the centrifugal action around the sun and they call it the halo orbit, and that's where it will actually stay. So it'll be rotating around the sun, but it won't be coming back toward Earth. It'll just be staying at the 1 million mile location. You know, they've done other satellites, so I'm sure it will be successful if they can get this thing off the ground and opened up. It's going to be something like 80 pyrotechnic devices have to open up, and motors have to turn on, and this thing's going to have to go through some complicated scenario to try to, you know, the telescope itself contains 18 gold dishes that have to, gold hexagonal shape that will have to open up and connect perfectly, and with this beryllium back, braces and everything it's connected to. All these things, the sunshade has to be done right. The solar panels have to be opened up properly. It's going to be an Oregonic nightmare, I guess you would call it, to try to open this all up and successfully do it. It's going to take months to do. I think a month and a half or 2 months to completely open all these parts as it's on its way to L1.
I believe that each of the three corners of the 18 panels of the main gold-plated mirror has actuators. And I think at the first focal point, I think there's a kind of a laser rangefinder. So to align that mirror, you have to measure the distance to each of those three points on each of the 18 mirrors and make that all come out right. I think that's the way it aligns itself in space. Isn't that true, Paul? K2RIW?
Yeah, it's got some kind of it's going to transmit a laser back to itself to look at all those, you know, and then the feedback is going to be able to change all these dozens of actuators. And I said L1 before, I meant L2, Lagrange point 2.
Quite a machine. Boy, there's an awful lot of things that have got to go just right, and no repair capability. Okay, we're going to end a little early tonight. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Roy. Maybe Roy's going to reissue his addresses for both the mailbag and for Space Talk. So, over to you, Roy, to tie the ribbons on it. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. And, yeah, if you have any email to send anyone, if you're so inclined, you could always send it to me, and I'll relay it to the specific person. The email address for mailbag questions for Dick, for topics you'd like me to cover, to volunteer some puzzles to save me from having to find them, and even to repeat what I say. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's mailbag at my call sign, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, .com. As well as I put up links to all the articles that I mentioned at roy.ac2gs.com. And if you want to see the picture of the Russian robot that's doing the things that Paul reported, I put up the image on my linking page as well. So, you know, mailbag at ac2gs and roy at ac2gs.com. Both of those places, keep it in mind. Use it when you need it. And thanks again to Dick and Paul, and thanks to everyone who participated tonight. And have a great week, guys. 73, this is AC2GS, and I'll be going clear now.
Bye-bye, you all.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is Kilowatt 2, Queen, Baker, Victor. I'm portable in Seoul, South Korea. I don't know if the repeater is on, but it's working sitting here in Seoul, South Korea. Kilowatt 2, Queen, Bravo, Victor. Portable HL.
W2VL repeater.
Is the repeater working? Kilowatt 2, Queen, Baker, Victor. Portable, South Korea. Listen. Q2BV, portable, HL, Queen.
That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Queen, Bravo, Victor. I'm portable in South Korea in Seoul. You seem to be working on the repeater. K2, be portable in South Korea, listening, repeat. Kilowatt 2, Queen, Bravo, Victor. Portable, South Korea. Listen.
That's tonight. tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Okay, 2QBV portable in South Korea. Listen, anybody there in New York?
W2VL repeater.
Kilowatt 2 Queen Bravo Victor. Portable.
Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.